The shiur this morning is being sponsored by Susan Mendy Sokol in memory of Sheldon David Shmuel Yosef Akohen Ben Chaim Vitzipora in Gan Eden Shamayla. What we're going to talk about today is the Inyana Diyuma related to the Parsha, related to the last few Parshios, and anybody who has even learned a nominal amount of pop psychology, taken AP Psych in high school, anything like that, is familiar with the tragedy, the story of Kitty Genovese from over 40 years ago, a young woman who lived in Kew Gardens, who had come back to her apartment at night and unfortunately encountered an attacker. And this attacker proceeded to attack her brutally over the course of a number of hours, leaving, coming back again. And as the New York Times reported it in the late 60s, that there was 38 members in her apartment complex who heard her cries, her screams for help, and nobody responded, and nobody did a thing while this woman was being attacked. And the New York Times did interviews, and they did research, and they spoke with the police, and it came out that all these individuals who were standing in the apartment complex where Kitty Genovese was being attacked and murdered heard what was going on, and were apparently apathetic to what was happening. And this was a big cause célèbre. It became a big issue in the national press. I think it painted, perhaps, unfortunately, New Yorkers for being apathetic, for not caring, and that's why out-of-towners are so much nicer than New Yorkers, and all those particular things. And this is something that's taught in psychology regarding the issue of the bystander effect, the idea that a person can be under trauma, under duress, under stress, someone is being attacked, and people stand by and they do nothing because they're apathetic, they're uncaring, they don't feel for what's going on. Psychologists after that time, after the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, again went back to look at the bystander effects. And they found that it was not necessarily the case that people from New York or New York City in particular were apathetic, uncaring, didn't like other human beings. That wasn't the issue at hand. But there is something that does go on within our minds when we see things going on, things unfolding, and we stand around and don't respond to those who are in help, those who are in need. The New York Times, in fact, 40 years after the original article that became famous in 1968, retracted much of what they wrote. The reporting was shoddy, the police reports were inaccurate, and it turns out that there were people there. In fact, her best friend who lived in the apartment complex was there to hold her, to cradle her in her last moments. She did come out to stop the individual. People did scream at him to go away. There were other factors going on. People thought it was a lover's quarrel, other issues that went into that particular case. But psychologists do point out that there are three things that do happen when a person does not respond when somebody is in need. When we see somebody in need, a tragedy unfolding, and we choose to sit back with other people around us, and we don't go and we don't respond and react. The first is that we have a fear of looking foolish. We have a fear of looking stupid. That, I ran into an emergency, there was a problem, and there was no problem, right? You called the police, you made a big scene, the ambulances came, and now you're embarrassed because it really wasn't a big deal, nothing in particular was going on, and I don't want to look like a fool because I responded when in fact nothing was really the matter at all and there was no emergency. The second point that psychologists point out is that perhaps it's not always clear to us if there is an emergency going on. We are bystanders to an event that could potentially be tragic unfolding in front of us, and maybe we're not clear. Maybe we don't want to overreact. We don't want to get somebody in trouble who should not get in trouble. We don't want to speak lashon hara about somebody who does not deserve to have their reputation dragged through the mud. And maybe it's not considered an emergency at this particular state. And for some reason, we don't respond because, I don't know, I don't want to get involved. It's not really so bad. And especially if we're standing with other people, if I'm standing with 7 or 8 other people and they're also observing what's going on, well, if they're not reacting to the emergency, well, then it must not be an emergency for me, because if they're not reacting, then I'm not reacting as well. The third is what psychologists refer to as the diffusion of responsibility. The idea that, yes, if there is an emergency going on, something is happening in front of me, and I choose to not respond, then even if I don't respond, and there is a problem, and I agree there's a problem, I will not be blamed at the end of the day, because there were other bystanders present observing what was going on, other people seeing what was happening in front of me, whether it was happening unfolding over time, whether it's happening very quickly, but I will not get the blame because there was 50 other people in the room seeing what's going on and they didn't respond as well. And therefore, I will not be blamed for not responding. These are perhaps some of the ideas that go into our mind, that go through our psychology when we see difficult, tragic, harmful situations going on and we don't respond in kind to those terms. What does the Torah have to say about the bystander effect? What does the Torah, as we see in this week's Parsha, as we see in last week's Parsha, and the Parshas before the beginning of Shmos, I would say that the beginning of Shmos is really the Parshas of the bystander. From these Parshas, we have story after story, account after account of people seeing things going on, observing things up close or from afar, and choosing to respond or choosing not to respond in the case of potential or actual tragedy. I'm going to present to you this morning a few stories, a few cases in point, and to see how our leaders or our non-leaders did not respond in certain cases, and what we can learn for ourselves about being a bystander or not being a bystander under particular or different circumstances. We're going to go in order of the parshas, going back to the beginning of Shmos, and we're going to proceed through this parsha. The Gemara in Maseches Sota and Daf Yud Aleph and Aleph tells us, Amar Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Amar Rav Simai, Shlosha Hayu Ba'osa Eitza. There were three people sitting at essentially what was the Vansi Conference of Mitzrayim, the meeting of the final solution at that point. Paro had brought together a number of advisors, a number of people to come and to figure out what to do with the Jewish problem, how to address the issue of all the Jewish people. They might come and take over the country. They're going to cause such problems. They're going to control the banks and the media, whatever it may be. And Paro convened a meeting of the minds to figure out what to do. Who was at this meeting? Three celebrities that we already know. Bilam, Iov, and Yisro. That is quite a brain trust right there, sitting in that room with Paro. Bilam, Iov, and Yisro, sitting together. So what happened? Bilam, Shiyat, Nerak. It was, in fact, the brilliant idea of Bilam that the Jews should be destroyed. Bilam, he needs no introduction, we know his history, not a fan of us already, said the Jews should be destroyed, and that's what happened to him. What happened to him? So we'll talk about that in a moment. Iov, so he was killed. Iov, Shishasak, Nidom B'Yisurim. Iov, who was quiet, who sat in the meeting and said absolutely nothing, he went through terrible tragedy Yisurim. One only needs to read not all of Sefer Iov, but just the first chapter of Sefer Iov to know all of the difficult things that Iov went through, his wife and his children and his family, Parnassa, illness, all types of terrible things, says the Medrash was in response to him doing nothing at that moment in time. And Yisro, Shebaruch, Yisro ran away. He said, I'm not going to sit here. I'm going to make a mechah. I'm going to make a protest. I'm obviously not going to fight Paro in hand-to-hand combat and stop him for what he's doing. And I'm not going to take on the Egyptian army. I can't do that. But what I can do is I can run away. I can get up and say, this is wrong, and I will have no part of it. And I will make a mechah, a protest, that this is unacceptable. What happened? Zachu b'nei vanav shiyashu b'lishkas agazis. It happened that his descendants eventually would sit on the Sanhedrin, would sit in the Beis HaMikdash, and become leaders of the Jewish people. So, let's go through the three people. We can understand that Yisro was not just a bystander. Yisro stood up, he made a protest, he tried to do something, he made it known to the leadership of Mitzrayim that what they were doing was 100% incorrect and was problematic. But the issue over here really lies with the difference in Iov and Bilam. At the end of the day, this is a question pointed out by Reb Chaim Shmulevitz in Hesichos Musar in Parshas Noach. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, at the end of the day, who did the worst thing? Did Iov do something worse than Bilam? Bilam advocated for genocide. Iov did nothing. But look at their punishments. The punishment of Bilam was a quick, sudden death. That was it. He was in battle. He was killed. End of story. The Gemara tells us in many places that Yisurim, difficulties in life, is much worse than death in many cases, because a person has to go through suffering again and again and again, and there's no end to the suffering. And yet, Bilam seems to receive a better punishment, so to speak, than Iov. Iov goes through the worst tragedies a person can imagine, unmentionable tragedies, because he did nothing. So says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, how is it the case that Yisurim come to Iov and Bilam gets a quick and painless death? Why is that fair? So he says in the name of the Brisker Rav, that Eov knew that any protest would be fruitless, and therefore he chose to remain silent. But nevertheless, he was punished, because Mida Keneged Mida, says the Briska Rav, just as one who is in pain cries out, even though he knows that his cries will not ease the pain. When you are hammering a nail into the wall, and the hammer strikes your thumb, and you say very, very not nice words, and you say very, very not nice things. So what's going to happen there? Is that going to do anything? Is that going to make the pain go away? Not necessarily. Okay, so studies show a person expresses their emotions, it helps deal with the pain and things like that, but it's not going to make the hammer not hit your thumb. But you screamed out in pain. You said something. You spoke up. You expressed your inner emotions. But Eov sat there and said nothing. He sat there as a bystander, didn't say no, but he didn't say yes. And therefore, he showed a lack of emotion. Where was his heart, says the Briska Rav? Where was his emotion and feeling for the pain of another person? A bystander who stands by and watches another person in pain, suffering, and expresses nothing. Maybe you cannot do CPR. Maybe you cannot do something. You're not in a position to do it. But you have to cry out. You have to say something. You have to express your emotion that the people should know that you have feeling inside and that you are not dead to what's going on around you. And that, says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, is step one, the lowest step of being a bystander. And that is to express something, to have feeling, to have emotion, to scream out if something is going on and you feel that that's incorrect, even if technically it might not change anything at the end of the day. In the beginning, as the story continues, we have a stark and a poignant lesson regarding the bystander effect. Regarding, not for Moshe Rabbeinu, but Moshe Rabbeinu's older brother. The pasuk says, "Vatiftach b'tareyu es hayeled, v'hinei nar bocha, v'tachma olav, v'tomer miyalde hivrimze." So the pasuk says that the daughter of Paro opened up the ark of that Moshe was in, v'tareyu, and she saw a boy. V'hinei, and behold, the na'ar was bocha. Now, as often we find in the Torah, it does not give a pronoun to define who we're talking about. All it says is, v'hanar bocha. V'tachma olav, and she had mercy on him, and she said, v'tomer miyaldi ivrim zeh. Now there's a lot of information in that pasuk. Someone's crying, the daughter of Paro sees a baby, she opens up and sees the baby, and then she comes to a conclusion based on no prior knowledge that this is a Jewish baby. How do we know that she knows that this is a Jewish baby? What in the pasuk reveals that? And also, who's crying? Because generally, if I wanted to describe a baby, would I ever use the word na'ar? What does a na'ar mean? It means a boy, it means an older boy, a young man. So why would it say na'ar here? Who's crying? Says the Baal HaTurim, in a beautiful pshat, he says, Ze Aaron, it wasn't Moshe that was crying. It was Aaron, the future Kohen, who was crying. Shehinachto Eitzel HaTeva. Because Aaron could not bear to stand by and not see what was going to happen with his brother. He had to be there. His brother's being sent out into the wild. What's going to be with him? I can't be a bystander, says Aaron, the young man, and not do something, not say something. I have to express myself in some way. And he stood off to the side, and he was crying. So Batya comes down to the river. She sees the Teva, the baby inside. And she sees a boy off to the side crying. And she puts two and two together. This boy is crying over his brother. This is a special situation here. Who would do such a thing? To put themselves in danger, to see what's going to happen? Says the daughter of Paro, this must be Mial Divrimzeh. This is a Jewish child. This is a Jew. This is a young man who's going to grow up to be a Jewish leader. Because I can tell that to go out and put yourself in danger, and to stand by and to cry out in pain, when your brother is suffering, that is a Jew. And I can tell that this is going to be from a Jewish family that's going to accomplish great things. So says the Baal HaTurim. And that's the same idea here. A young Aaron HaKohen. How do you become an Aaron HaKohen? How do you raise a child to be a Rodev Shalom, an Ohev Shalom? You raise a child who stands by and cries when other people are suffering, when people are in danger. That's how you raise a child to be an Aaron HaKohen. To not be a silent bystander, but to be someone who stands there and expresses their emotions when someone is suffering and in pain. We next encounter the younger brother of Aaron, Moshe, at a later stage in life, when he goes out to witness the Mitzri beating a Jew. He grew up, he went out to his brothers, Vayar Bisivlosam, he sees them in their suffering, Vayar Ish Mitzri, and he saw an Egyptian man, Maka Ish Ivri Me'achav, beating one of the Jews of his brothers. That's a funny phrase, right? Again, to be clear, I did not write the Torah. But if I did write the Torah, I would have said, Vayar Ish Mitzri, Maka Ish Ivri. And he saw an Egyptian hitting a Jew. What does the word Me'achiv have to do at all with anything in the pasuk? Vayifen cho v'cho, and he turned there and there. Vayar kenish, and he saw no one was there. Vayachas ha-mitzri, and he killed the mitzri. Vayitmin b'cho, and he buried him in the sand. Now the pasuk shot being is he turned there and there to see what? Why did Moshe turn right and left? To make sure that nobody was watching him, so he should get away with his vigilante crime, right? So he should make sure he could get away with that. But says Rav Azariah Figo. Rav Azariah Figo is one of the great Italian darshanim of the 1600s. His sefer, the Bin El Itim, is incredibly popular, but the problem is the drashos are very, very long. So nobody really learns anymore, but there are beautiful drashos in there. I think it's so long, somebody actually published a kitzer Bin El Itim, like a shortened version of it, because the drashos are so long. But there are such beautiful ideas in the Bin El Itim, and this is one of them. Let's read together. This is from Drush Chaf Hei, the 25th Drush. Look at what Rav Azariah Figo writes. He says, "Ve'odenu misparer azel." Let me explain to you what's going on. Moshe Rabbeinu saw something that was the opposite of what the shleimus of the Jewish people should have been. Moshe Rabbeinu saw an event that made the Jewish people not look good. Ki ish mitzri hayamak ish ivri, ba'aval meforsam. A Egyptian was beating a Jew in public. In public. This was not in some back alley. In public, an Egyptian was beating a Jew. Ve'ilu hayu hamitzri ve'ivri shneam levadam ein roeh. If it was just the two of them, by themselves, nobody would have seen that. Hecharish Moshe melashim es Yisrael. Moshe would have remained silent from castigating the Jewish people. Shlonefchu ala kol ha'oyev. That they didn't attack this Egyptian who was beating their friend. If it was in some back alley and nobody saw it, so then I can't judge you because who else could have seen what was going on? Ki lo yadu me'uma, they didn't know. Ach lo ha'yadav rakeh, but that's not what happened. Ki ha'mitzri hik es ivri me'achav. He was hitting him while his brothers were watching. All of the Jews were standing by and watching what was going on. Mivein achav shel ha'ivri. Shaya besocham. They were in the midst of the whole city. Umiyadam lachohu ve'heko. And he took them and he beat him. V'cheshev Moshe Rabbeinu al v'shal Moshe Rabbeinu thought. Yakumu kal achav misaviv levloas ha'mitzri. Let's do some math. There's 100 Jews here, there's one Mitzri, and he's beating up your brother. And you're standing there, and you're doing nothing? La socho chatiche chatichos. They could have sliced him and diced him, he says, literally. They could have torn this guy apart, and they didn't do anything. V'alkein vayifen cho v'cho. And therefore Moshe Rabbeinu turned to the right and to the left. V'chol sevivo se'ivri asher hayusham. And he looked around and said, where is everyone? What's going on? A Jew is being beaten in public, and no one is responding. Omdim al ha-mitzvah, they stand off to the side. Liros hayach yiskomu menegan ha-mitzrim. What are you going to do to this mitzri? Vareki ein ish, and he saw there is no man. Lo haya b'neihem shum gever begovrin. There is no man to stand up. Vein sham alev lasos poa mu'ula, and no one's doing anything. Ad shekamhu, until he got up. Ki ruach Hashem noses abo, because the Spirit of God was moving him. V'hikas ha-mitzri, and he killed the mitzri. Ubli safek, without a doubt, haya navoch badato. And after that happened, Moshe's head was spinning. He was confused. Eich nimtza chisaron kazeh me'uma me'ula kazu. How could this lack of stepping up and not doing something be found in this nation? Where are the Jewish people? Lebilti hispael me'avel meforsim kamo. To not do something in such a public way. How is it possible, Moshe? Where are the Jewish people when their brothers being attacked and they don't do a thing, not a word? Moshe Rabbeinu was confused. He didn't know what to do, and that was his issue. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu was bothered, because he looked around and saw nobody doing anything. That is the next step of being a bystander. To stand around and to see something going on and not a single person says something is unacceptable, says Moshe Rabbeinu. It's not the meat of a Jew. This is a exalted nation. We're an important people. And this is how we should behave in such a case if there's no idea of what's people stepping up. One second. Let's see. Can we mute ourselves over here? One second. I don't know, whatever. Hope we mute. Okay, good. So that's what he says over here. Good? Fine. That's the next step over here. Let's move on. That itself is a powerful message. And that itself, you know, Dayenu, if we stopped here, you know, that Musar from Azariah Figo would be enough. But there's more to learn as well. Another day soon after, Moshe Rabbeinu comes across two Jews fighting with each other, and immediately he intervenes. And then he flees Egypt, he rescues the daughters of Yisro, he's on a Superman-type mission already, from the harassment of the local shepherds, and it culminates with the Kadosh Baruch Hu asking Moshe Rabbeinu to be the leader of the Jewish people. Rav Yitzchak Karo, you are all familiar with his nephew, Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Karo had a distinguished uncle as well, who was a Rebbe of his, Rav Yitzchak Karo. So Rav Yitzchak Karo wrote a sefer on Chumash called the Toldos Yitzchak. And he points out that there's a powerful progression from Moshe Rabbeinu's first encounter to his last encounter in this episode. Listen to what he says. Vayifen cho v'cho, sipra ha-Torah gimel ma'asiyos binyanav. We find in the course of about 20 psukim, Moshe Rabbeinu doing three very similar things. Echad vayar ish mitzri vayach. He saw an Egyptian hitting another, vayach is mitzri. He saw an Egyptian hitting. Sheni, vihine shnei anashim ivrim nitzim vayomer l'rash alama tekarecha. And then he sees the two Jews fighting. And then he sees Yisro and his seven daughters. Lodia, what's the point here? Shemosha haya dayan b'teva. Ubal Mishpat. Moshe in his nature was a person of judgment. Dai lo dai hamitzri shehikali Yisrael shehargu. Now, you'll tell me, okay, you see a non-Jew picking on a Jew, okay, very nice, you're going to step in and you're going to be a hero, you'll call the ADL, you'll call Shomrim, you'll call the police, whatever you want, of course you're going to step up and say something. Aval gam Yisrael im Yisrael. But says Rav Yitzchak Karo, a hero also steps up when a Jew is hitting another Jew. When a Jew's hurting another Jew, that's also a place to be a hero and to step in. Shahayu Mariven Shalo Hechriach Lo Yehadus, Sha'echad Yisov Echad Mitzri. In that case, you'll say, okay, two Jews fighting, two Jews being mean to each other. Whatever. You know, it happens. No. Avlim Hayos Shishneim Yisraelim. Amar Lo Russia Lamitzika. He says to the perpetrator, Russia, what are you doing? And he goes a step further in his ability to stand up. Velo dai elu. And that was not sufficient as well. You'll say, okay, he's getting involved with Jews. He's helping Jews. A Jew helping a Jew. Of course, Moshe Rabbeinu is going to step up. Ava im hayos, shishtei kisos gayim. Two groups of non-Jews. A non-Jew persecuting a non-Jewish woman. Says Moshe Rabbeinu hayibeinav, ha'evel sh'os hazela zela ra. Another human being. Harming another human being, Vayaka Moshe v'yoshin, and Moshe stands up and he saves them. Says Rav Yitzchak Karo, the three stories here are all building on top of each other, are all progressing. The person starts with something that seems to be patently obvious to step up, not be a bystander, something a little bit less obvious, until no single person in the world should be free from us being able to save them, to help them, no matter who they are, no matter what the background is, to be able to do something, to say something, and to not be a bystander, to let another person persecute another human being. Let's fast forward to this week's parsha. Vayehi b'chatzi halayla, and it was at midnight. Hika kol b'chor be'eretz Mitzrayim, that all of the firstborns would be hidden Mitzrayim. Mi b'chor paro hayoshiv al kiso, from the greatest firstborn, from the chair of paro, ad b'chor hashvi, until you had a captured, lowly firstborn, asher b'beis habor, that is in the pit, that is in jail, v'chol b'chor behema, and even the firstborn of an animal. Now, there's a lot of firstborns in this pasuk, right? There's kol b'chor Mitzrayim, there's b'chor paro, there's b'chor shevi, the one who's captured, and also animals. So we have four b'choros in this parsha, right? Look at Rashi. Rashi says, what does the word kol b'chor come to include? Because kol b'chor is extra. You just told me, everybody. All the way from Paro down to, you know, down to the bottom. What's the difference? So Rashi says, af shal uma acheres hu b'mitzrayim. Everyone has the Rashi? Right? Af shal uma acheres hu b'mitzrayim. Even if there is a visitor, you have somebody vacationing from Singapore in Egypt that night, and they're staying in the Four Seasons of Cairo, and they're a firstborn son, and they're there, they will also be killed that night. They will also be a firstborn who will be killed. Now, what does this have to do then with the firstborn prisoner of war? What's that all about? The one who's in Shevi, the one who's captured. So Rashi says, why is it that the firstborn captured who's in jail needs to be killed? So the first reason, says Rashi, is because they are rejoicing over the downfall of Israel. They were sitting all smug in jail and saying, our God protects me, but the Jewish God is weak, so my God's better. So Hashem wanted to be sure that everyone's clear about who's in charge, so Hashem said, I'm in charge, you're dead. And then the second thing Rashi says is, v'od shelo yomru yiraseinu habiyah ha-peronesu. And the other thing they shouldn't say is that, they deserve this, I'm better than them, I'm an exception to the rule. Now, this reasoning is only why the captives were killed for Makas Bechoros. But you'll notice that Rashi gives no explanation as to why a visiting firstborn from another country and a temporary resident from outside Mitzrayim should be killed. That's a different justification. They're not the same thing. I'm vacationing with my family in Cairo, and I'm a firstborn son, so why should I be persecuted? Because I'm visiting there. I have nothing in particular against the Jewish people. I'm just there. I'm not part of the government persecution. Says Rav Noach Weinberg, Rosh Yeshiva Eish HaTorah, in a brilliant pshat. He says the answer is obvious. And it's so obvious that Rashi didn't even have to say it. You cannot be a tourist. You cannot be a temporary resident in a country that is committing genocide. That is not a thing. If a country around you is killing innocent people and you are vacationing there, that is not acceptable. Because you are part and parcel in participating in what that country is doing. If you stay there, says Noach Weinberg, even if you're not actively involved, you are condoning the atrocity and you are part of it. The captive in jail can't get out. He's stuck there. So Rashi needs to justify the killing for the firstborn. Because why? He can't escape. He has to be in jail. So Rashi has to come up with two reasons why he is being killed. But there's no need to explain why a temporary resident's firstborn is killed. How can you live in a country that's persecuting another people? That means you're party to the crime, says Noach Weinberg. Rashi doesn't need to explain that, because any feeling human being should understand why it's a problem that somebody vacationing from Singapore and staying in the Four Seasons in Mitzrayim in the midst of genocide is doing something wrong. There's no difference whether you're doing something actively or you're tacitly condoning it. They have a quote from Edmund Burke, who was a famous British statesman. They debate whether the quote is correct. But all that's necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men and women to do nothing. You have to stand back and do nothing. To be around and to be associated and to be in such a place and to do nothing makes you part of it. And that's why a firstborn vacation in Mitzrayim was going to be killed. Because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time and chose the wrong place to go for vacation. They quote from Elie Wiesel in an interview in 1986, that the opposite of love is not hate. It's indifference. When you show indifference to somebody, you show that you don't love them, that you don't care for them. To sit back and see another person suffering, and to say nothing, to not scream out like Moshe's older brother Aaron, to not say something when you have the ability to pick up the phone and to send an email to contact somebody, is a lack of a Jewish soul. To not step up and to say something, to be actively participating when other people are involved and being hurt. Perhaps we could argue that the Bechoros of Klal Yisrael, that the firstborn of the Jewish people, were sanctified through being saved during Makas Bechoros, right? And where does the Kedusha of the firstborn come of a Jew? Because they were saved by Makas Bechoros. Now, I'd like to suggest that they lost their Kedusha. We all know that I am a firstborn who technically should have had the rights to serve in the Beis HaMikdash and to come with all the rights of a Kohen, so I guess I'm a little bit bitter about it. So we lost it. We lost it when we had that Kedusha because by the Chet HaEgel. So I want to show you that the same thing that gave my predecessors, those Bechoros before me, the right to have that Kedusha for that small window in time before the Chet HaEgel is the same Midah that we lost it with. The Medrash and Rashi explain that Hashem specially designed Shevet Levi to serve him. They were considered the king's special legions, special army of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And during the tragic events of the Chet HaEgel, when so many Jews served the idol, the tribe of Levi was stalwart in their opposition in standing against that Chilul Hashem. And therefore Levi was chosen to serve in the Mikdash in place of the firstborns, who again, me and my predecessors, were chosen to do it originally. But does that really make sense? How many Jews actually sinned by the Chet HaEgel? How many Jews actually worshipped the Avodah Zarah? Do you know? 3,000. 3,000 total, out of all of Klal Yisrael, actually went and worshipped that golden calf. So then, why does all of Shevet Levi come to replace the rest of the firstborn? 3,000 Jews is a drop in the bucket of what was going on and who was there at that time. Why didn't Hashem select anybody who didn't serve the Egel Azov, right? That should be it. Whoever didn't worship Avodah Zarah should get chosen to be the Masharis, the servants, the Avadim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Beis HaMikdash. The Chidushei HaRim, Rav Yisro Meyer Alter, the Rebbe of Gur, so he's quoted in the Sefer Mayana Shel Torah in Parshas Kisisa. This is quoted similarly by his grandson, the Sfas Emes, in Parshas Bamidbar. But let's read to what it says in Mayana Shel Torah. Hayu amnam harbe yosim b'bnei Yisrael shelo sagdu le'egel. There were many, many Jews, much more Jews, who didn't worship the Egel Azav than who did worship the golden calf. Sharei nenshu rak shaloshim elef ish. It was only around this 30,000, 3,000. Achlo haya behem ha'oz, let's say, bekerem neged ovdei ha'egel. But do you know what? All those Jews who stood by and watched their brothers and sisters bow down to a golden calf, did they say anything? Did they speak up? Did they make a mecha? Did they say, guys, you're making a chil Hashem? You were just in Mitzrayim, you know, 50 days ago. Did you guys remember anything that just happened? Rabim ratzu leyos omdim min hatzad. They stood on the side, literally a bystander. Omdim min hatzad. They stood on the side. Rabim ratzu lemaneh memachlokas. I don't want to get involved in machlokas. Who knows what's going to be? It's going to be lashon hara. I don't want to get involved. There's going to be fallout. There's shiduchim. All types of things. I don't want to get involved. Rak halaviim hisyatzvu lekarev leman kvod Hashem yisparach. It was only the tribe of Levi who stood up for an honor, for the glory of Hashem, v'lachu cherev biyadam, and they took swords in their hand. Lilchom neged ovdei avodah zarah, to fight against those people who were making a chil Hashem. Lefichach amar Hashem yisparach. Therefore says Hashem, vayuli halevim. The levim, they're mine. Do you know why? Because they were there for me. They stood up in the face of a chil Hashem. They stood up leman kvod Hashem. Va'amar al-Kain HaMedrash, the Medrash says, Shikarvu es atzman li. They brought themselves to me. Shikarvu elai v'kinu ba'ofen pa'il l'chvodi. They were po'il. They acted. They did something. They weren't bystanders. They got up and they made a macha in the face of Chil Hashem. The punishment was not necessarily for worshiping Egel Azav. It was simply the idea that you cannot be a leader. It was midah k'neged midah. Says Hashem, I need leaders. And to stand by while another person is doing the wrong thing and to remain silent is not leadership. I need leaders. Shevet Levi are leaders. Okay, I'm not going to fault you. I'm not going to say that you're bad, says Hashem, for being a bystander, even though there's what to talk about. But he says, but you can't tell me you're a leader. You can't tell me you didn't drop the ball when somebody was being hurt and people were being hurt and you said nothing at the end of the day. And therefore, you have to be ready to stand up and cry out against injustice, to be ready to fight publicly for truth. Even, and if not, you're not capable of being a leader in that case. The Talmidim once asked the Baal Shem Tov. The Gemara in Chulam Kuftes says that for every single thing that Hashem forbade in this world, He provided us something permissible of the same sort. There's no type of hana, there's no type of pleasure that does not have a permissible outlet for every Jew. Amar la yalsa le Rav Nachman. Yalsa said to Rav Nachman, Kol de asulan rachmana shara la kavase. Whatever Hashem prohibited, He made an equal, permissible way. Asulan dama shara lan kavda. It's usur for us to eat blood, according to the Torah. We can eat liver. Liver has an aspect of blood to it. It's full of blood, where I have an aspect of blood. Kavda nida damtar. We have a husband and wife at permissible times, not permissible times. Chalav behema, chalav chaya. Certain types of fats. Chazir mocha, shibuta. And famously, the pig has the shibuta fish, this mystical fish that apparently tastes like pork that nobody can find. But we have such a fish that tastes like pork. Now we have impossible burgers and all types of things. But, you know, we have a way to create these things. There's nothing that a Kadosh Baruch Hu made in the world that doesn't have a permissible way for us to enjoy it. So they asked the Baal Shem Tov, what about kfira? To be a heretic? Is there a kosher way to be a kofer? To be a denier of Hashem? Person gets a geschmack out of saying, you know, ah, there's no God, I can do what I want, I'm in charge, nobody's looking out for me, I'm doing my own thing. Is there a kosher form of heresy? So the Baal Shem Tov said, if someone is in need of tzedakah and food, and they come in the middle of the winter, and they say they haven't had a meal in 3 days, their children are at home, they're hungry, what happens? At that moment, we all become an apikoros. We all should become apikorosim and say, there's no God, there's just me. When somebody turns to you and says, you know, I'm in great need, I have a situation, I need your help, things are complicated, can you really help me out, give me a hand, give me some guidance, give me some of your time, some of your money. So there you need to be a kofer, you need to be an apikoros, and say, there's no Hashem, there's just me. Because what do we do too often? We say to that person, Hashem yazor, Hashem will help you. Be'ezus Hashem, you'll get through it. You know, be'ezus Hashem, things will be okay. No, says the Baal Shem Tov. In that moment, become an apikoros. There's no Hashem. There's just you. And stop being so frum about it. Because you keep on saying, Hashem will help, Hashem will provide, Hashem will take care of you. No, no, no. You should provide. You should take care of them. And you should help the person out. So says the Baal Shem Tov his Talmidim, that's a kosher form of heresy. You can be an apikoros for those few minutes and say, there's no God, there's just me. I need to help out this family. I need to help out this patient. I need to help out the person who's suffering. I need to help out this couple. Whatever it may be, there's only me and there's no Hashem. So that's a kosher form of being a heretic. There's no such thing as being an innocent bystander in Judaism. The Torah tells us, Lo sa'amod al dam reyacha. You may not stand by idly while blood is being spilt. When ordinary people don't say things and other people are suffering, then there's no morality anymore. We need to be better about saying something, going to the right people in the right times, reaching out, doing what we can, instead of saying back and saying, it's too big for me, I can't get involved, I don't want to ruin this person's reputation, smi lashon hara. There's always a kosher avenue to help somebody out when they're in need. Whether it could be abuse of all types of forms, bullying, get refusal, Jews making chil Hashem, there's no such thing as not doing something. Saying from as lowly as saying a parak of Tehillim to as great as getting involved physically, whatever it may be, but there's no such thing as we saw from the last 5-6 stories in the beginning of Shmos of being a bystander. What about our children? Bullying that goes on, unfortunately. Sometimes kids will be mean and they'll say insensitive things, but there's bullying that goes on all the time in our schools, unfortunately. The vast majority of students, in the cases of bullying, are going to be bystanders. Most children are not bullies. But most children, unfortunately, are going to be bystanders. They say that 85% of children have witnessed bullying by their peers of another person and stood by and done nothing. It's hard. We're not saying it's hard. But we can do a better job of being mechanech our children to be able to stand up and to say something. Because when students see adults witness a bullying and they don't say anything, they think that the adults are condoning the bullying that's going on. And when they see their friends stand by and not say anything, they assume that their friends condone it as well. Like we said at the beginning, yes, perhaps inside they want to say something. They don't want to look dumb. They don't want to look foolish. They want to look not cool. They don't want to get beat up themselves. All these things that go into these factors. We have to do a much better job of training our children to not be bystanders, to have a bit of a backbone, to stand up, to say something, to know that they have your support no matter what happens, and that you'll be proud of them. You'll reward them when they stand up, and they're not a silent bystander, and to let them know that you have their backing, and you're going to support them no matter what. Rav Itzel of Elazhin was the son of Rav Chaim of Elazhin. Rav Chaim of Elazhin was a Talmud of Vilna-Gaon. Rav Itzel of Elazhin was his son. His Talmud, his son-in-law, was the Beis HaLevi, whose Talmud was his son Rav Chaim, whose Talmud was son Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, whose Talmud was his son Rabbi Soloveitchik, all the way down to this day. So we're not so many generations away, going back to the 1800s. So Rav Itzel of Elazhin quotes a Gemara in Sota and Daf Mem Tes. Listen to this Gemara. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair Omer. Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, the author of the famous Braisa, which is the source for Mesilas Yesharim, Omer, Mishacharav Beis HaMikdash, when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, Boshu Chaveirim Ubnei Chorin V'chafu Rosham V'nedaldolu Anshei Maisa. The pious people of Yichus were ashamed, people of deeds were lowered, V'gavru Bali Zroa, the forceful people, the brazen people, V'bali Lashon, the people who spread Lashon Hara, were overpowered. The people who overpowered them. V'ein Doresh V'ein Mavakish. And there's no one who teaches in Klal Yisrael who's able to request to have mercy for us. And we have no one to rely on except for our Father in heaven. Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol Omer, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol says, "Beyom shecharav Beis HaMikdash, from the days the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, sharu chakikma lemahabi kaspara, the Chachamim started to descend to be like children of teachers, v'safra k'chazina v'chazina ka'ama da'ara, and the teachers of children became like heads of the Beis HaKnesses, like the Gabbai in the Shul, and the heads of the Beis HaKnesses became like commoners," meaning everybody was lowered a level in their status. Azlev adildzlev ein shoa ein mevakesh, and there's no one who teaches Klal Yisrael, no one who can request mercy for us, Ella Amili Shain, who should we rely on? Ella Vina Shabashamayim, Beikvos Mashiach Chutzpah Yaske. Because in the days of the coming of Mashiach, brazenness, chutzpah, will be rampant. Be'alma Yeshlan Lishain, and what can we rely on? Nobody, Ella Vina Shabashamayim, except for Hashem. Says Rav Itzel of Elazhin. Why does the Mishnah here in Masechta Sota say three times, Ve'alma Yeshlan Lishain, Ella Vina Shabashamayim? They have no one to rely on except for Hashem. Would have been easier to simply say it at the end of the whole episode. Why does it have to interrupt all three stages and to say, the only thing we have to rely on is the Kaddish Baruch Hu? So Rav Itzel explained that the expression that comes at the end of the Maimer is actually part of the Klala. The statement, V'ein lanu ela al mila heisha'ein, ela vinu shva shemayim, that we have no one to rely upon except for Hashem, is not a statement that's supposed to make you feel warm and fuzzy. It's actually part of the curse of the days before Mashiach. When things are difficult, and the leaders of the generation don't know what to do, and they throw up their hands and they say, V'alma yeshlan l'hisha'in alavinu shashmayim, what can we rely upon except for Hashem? And everyone around us turns and says, there's nothing to do be mechazik the klal, there's nothing to do to solve this problem, there's nothing to do to get involved, there's nothing I can do to fix this issue, and we should simply rely on Hashem, then that's a bad sign for the Jewish people. That's a generation where chutzpah is yazgi, where chutzpah is everywhere, and we have nowhere to turn. And therefore the Gemara repeats this three times, so we should know that this is part of the klala, and it's not a declaration of your amunah, that Hashem yazor, that Hashem will help. When you need help, and you turn to others, and all they offer is Hashem yazor, mirtz Hashem, beazras Hashem, it's not a sign, this is a sign of the lowliness of the generation, not the greatness of the generation of their amunah. So, Ad Kan, the story of the beginning of the Tzias Mitzrayim, and really the story, perhaps, of the generation that we're in, that we need to be better of not being a generation that says, Hashem Yazor. I'm all for Amunah. I want to be clear here. I'm all for Amunah and relationship with Hashem. But that's between me and Hashem. But when it comes to other people, we can't be bystanders anymore. We have to get involved. We have to speak up. We have to say things, whether it's young who are being hurt, old who are being hurt. We have to get up and say that, for a moment, I'm a kofer, an apikoras, and Hashem's not going to do it, and I have to get involved and do the best I can with Torah guidance and looking at our rabbanim and poskim and looking at our leadership to know the responsible and the proper way to do things, but indefinitely at the end of the day to get involved and to no longer be bystanders. Have a good day.